Welcome back, everybody, to the podcast. My name is Brandon Bagg, and I'm sitting here with the one and only Dan Magan.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Honestly, thank you so much for doing this. This is a big treat for me. I've had the pleasure of following your career for probably the last 15 years.
Oh,
I think.
Wow.
Great. I think your second album is when
I remember
the first time I heard that record, Nice, Nice, Very Nice. I was like, I think it's 2009 it came out.
August 2009, yeah.
So I would have been just 25. Mm. And I remember thinking like, how do we not know this guy? Like, he's got
billions of people didn't. You know,
he's got all these references about this neighborhood, and I was living in East Van at the time, and one of the things I was initially drawn to and have been throughout your career is your lyrics.
Mm, thank you.
And I wanted to ask, like, I've listening to specifically with the reference to that album, you know, songs like Some People. Where you have that opening line about you've had not enough to make you drunk, but just enough to make you tired.
Yeah.
And it's very that I listen to that record and I'm like, I'm very 25 in this city. Yeah. And then
as you say those words, I can picture my basement apartment that I had, you know, when I wrote those lyrics and the image in my head and playing Mario Kart and getting stoned with my roommate, you know.
Totally. Yeah. And then, you know, later, like you almost 10 years later, you've got, Cold in the Summer, where you've got a reference about helicopter parenting.
Yeah.
And just the way that your lyrics have, I guess, matured over the years.
Yeah. Or at least like topically adjusted to my life, yeah. You know? Yeah.
And I guess my question is, do you approach over the course of the last 20 years that you've been at this game? Do you approach, especially being a father now, than you 20 years ago, being a young guy coming onto the scene, how do you approach writing both music and lyrically differently than you did?
I definitely do. I think when I was starting out, I really was like emulating my heroes. You know what I mean? I was sort of like, there was all these people that I wanted to sound like or be like. And so I was kind of doing my best to, you know, play the same game as them. And then, as I've gotten older, I feel like the threshold of what I'm willing to accept lyrically has gotten higher. You know what I mean? I feel like in my younger days, like, oh, if it sounds poetic, that's enough. It doesn't have to actually mean anything as long as it sounds poetic. And now it's not enough for me. I need to be able to justify it to myself and say like, no, every line in the song has to say something, has to unlock some hidden truth, has to, you know, tell the truth somehow. And I feel there's something, I think when you're young and you're writing music, you're sort of just throwing everything at the wall and you haven't developed your muscle memory or your skills that much. And so there is a powerful thing in that, like the power of naivety and the power of sort of being young and willing to break rules because you don't know the rules and that kind of stuff is kind of cool. And I think, you know, that's often why in the music industry, we glamorize and fetishize youth so much is because there's so much about being a young artist where you're just sort of like, I don't know, I'm just trying a bunch of stuff. And then you have kids or you get responsibility or if you're successful, you have wealth or all of these things kind of come into play. And then your life changes quite a lot from the way it was when you were first starting out. And I think that at that point, a lot of people either get worse or they get better. And I would like to say that I'm in the latter, you know, group in that I think I'm writing better songs now than I've ever written in my life. And I think a lot of that comes down to my willingness to always try to get like, you know, it's like you can kind of rest on your laurels a bit, especially if you have a little bit of success, you can kind of be like, oh, I know how to do this, you know? Mm-hmm. And then you immediately start getting worse. And I just will not do that. Like I can't, I've always had a very tireless work ethic. And so for me writing, you know, obviously I'm like anyone else. I have these bursts of the muse, you know, and you're kind of like, oh my God, I'm writing down lyrics furiously and I got to capture this. But I'm also, you know, a literature major. And the thing that university taught me to do was edit and edit and edit and edit. And so I won't let a song out the door now unless I feel like I literally can't make it any better. Like it's at the extent of my ability, every consonant, the way every vowel rolls off, the way that every line leads into the next line. there's often just tiny little changes you can make that will take something good and make it great. Mm-hmm. And so it's painful. You know, as like Jason Isbell has a quote about how writing songs is like doing the New York Times crossword during a therapy session. You know, it's like you're mining the depths of your soul and trying to tell the truth through whatever it is that you are. And at the same time, it's this like impossible puzzle. And lucky for me, I love puzzles. So yeah. It's a good pastime for me. And it really, when I'm in the throngs of writing, it occupies my mind 24 hours a day. It's like, I'm dreaming about it. I'm thinking about it first thing when I wake up, I'm in the shower, I'm humming it, you know, I'm picking up the kids from school and I'm humming the second verse that I know I can be better. I'm humming it to myself as we're walking back home or whatever. And it's really in there. And I feel like as I've gotten older, yeah, like the stakes have gotten higher. If I'm going to be working, if I'm going to be touring, if I'm going to not be with my kids, if I'm going to abandon my wife with our two wretched children and go on the road for 8 weeks, like it has to matter more because A, it has to pay the bills and B, I feel like anything that takes me away from my family has to be meaningful. And so I also picture, you know how like when you're 12 or 13 and you kind of really start digging into music yourself and you start discovering things, at some point my kids are going to dig into my catalog. Like might be years from now, I don't know. Might be when they're teenagers or maybe never, but I have this image of them really digging into my work and going like, you know, because a lot of my songs have sort of just been wallpaper for them. Like they're kind of just in and around, you know, me. And so they hear them secondhand or they, you know, catch them at the cafe and go, oh, this is your song, Dad. But at some point I picture them with headphones on, really listening. And I feel like I owe it to them to make sure that it's great. I don't want to let them down. And when they're exploring art and getting excited about it as teenagers, hopefully in the same way that I did, music was a real companion for me. You know, it was sort of like a best friend when you're lonely. And I would hope that, you know, this work is up to the test, that they could discover it and go like, oh man, you know, my old man was onto something.
Yeah. You talk about, you mentioned everything, more weight to it now, everything needing more meaning. I wanted to ask you about the song you dedicated to Scott Hutchinson. Because
speaking of weight, yeah, that's a heavy one.
he's from Scotland.
Yeah.
The Scotland indie scene. You're obviously in Vancouver. How much did you guys cross paths?
So we had met once. I didn't know him well. We'd met at Glastonbury. And we had a lot of mutual friends. He toured with Broken Social Scene, or good buddies of mine, and Winter Sleep, same. And he was about my age. I think maybe he was a few years older. And I just, you know, he was kind of in the same scene. Like we would cross paths, we would narrowly miss them at festivals and stuff like that. And when I did meet him, you know, total sweetheart. We hung out for maybe 25 minutes or so and then, you know, moseyed on. And so when he passed, I remember going and looking at his Twitter. For the first thing I read was like the day before he passed was like, you know, this sort of alert announcement from the Frightened Rabbits social media saying, we're looking for Scott. We can't find him. We're really worried about him. He's not in a good way. And if you see him, please, you know, call the missing persons line or whatever. And I was like, oh, Jesus, you know, that's awful. And then the next day, seeing the next tweet saying, you know, the horrible news. And I remember going to Scott's Twitter page and seeing that he'd basically written like a very brief suicide note on Twitter that just said, I'm away now, thanks. Mm-hmm. Something along those lines. And I was like a puddle. I was just a mess. And Bowie and Prince had both died in and around that time. And Scott's death hit me like 1,000 times harder because he was like kind of a peer, you know? I mean, his Frightened Rabbits was way more famous, but I considered him a peer. Like he was, you know, we were about the same age and we had lots of mutual friends and we were in the same circles. And I don't know. It was sort of like the Robin Williams thing, you know, or like somebody could give so much joy, could be so creative.
Could be so sad.
Exactly. Like they could foster joy for so many other people, but not for themselves. And they couldn't let it in. Like their brain wouldn't let the joy in for themselves. And that just destroyed me. It made me so sad. And I was thinking about all the, you know, Frightened Rabbit fans all around the world getting in their cars and going to work. And like, you know, you can't call in sick because the singer of your favorite band died, you know? Mm-hmm. So like all these people getting on with their lives, but knowing that, you know, this person that they loved so much was going to be dead. That was really, that's kind of where the song started, you know, that the imagery were crying in the shower, crying in the car park, crying in the office towers. But really the song is about community. I mean, at the time I was kind of thinking like, I wish I could have said these words to Scott. I don't know if it would have mattered. You know, I think when somebody's convinced that the world is better without them, I don't know how to convince them otherwise, other than to, you know, say and re-say all the cliches over and over mm-hmm. and over again, and hope that it gets in. All the platitudes of, you know, life worth being living. I really do believe that despite the evidence else otherwise, the pros of existence really do outweigh the cons, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that music for me and concerts, really live shows, are sort of like the atomic unit whereby we can try and remind everybody of that, you know, that in community we do better. When we feel like we are part of something bigger than ourselves, when we feel small in the and in flow, when we sort of feel the weight and the intensity of and the gravitas of like an event that's big and joyful, that it opens up empathy in us, it opens up kindness in us, and it allows us to be kinder to ourselves too. The weight is lifted. You know, when you leave a great concert, you should feel like, I've said this before, but like you should feel like you want to climb a mountain and mm-hmm. plant a, you know, a garden and bake a cake and make out with someone and, you know, go for a run in the rain and call your mom, or, you know, you should feel like John Cusack with the ghetto blaster over his head, you know, and what's that?
Say anything.
Yeah. Those moments where you're just lost in it, you know? Yeah. And I feel like when you have those moments, it kind of gives you like life juice, you know, it's like spirit fuel for the next little while, and you can get through your life and all the ups and downs and inner workings of your mind, roller coaster, meat grinder mm-hmm. life. And so Scott was able to do that for so many people. And I feel like that song is just a gesture of community. You know, so come find us if you can. We'll be unified and sad. We'll be in your corner. Also, of course, you know, Scott had a song called The Woodpile. Mm-hmm. And in the chorus of that song, he says, "Would you come back to my corner? Spent too long alone tonight." And it's such a beautiful song. And, you know, we'll speak in our secret tongues is one of my favorite Frightened Rabbit lines. And he had this way of communicating loneliness in songs that was so, so beautiful. And hilariously, ironically, feeling alone is the greatest connector, because it is the thing that unites us more than anything, you know, is the mutual feeling of existential loneliness and dread. So it's a reference to that song. It's a reference to him. But I often, when I'm introducing that song at shows now, I'll say, you know, this was written for Scott, but can't help him now, but it can help us, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this is for anyone who's feeling the weight or the momentum of a downturn.
Yeah. That's sad and beautiful.
Which is life. Life is sad and beautiful.
Which is life. I wanted to touch back on, you're talking about community and the connection in a live show. And I remember this moment in was one of your shows at it was a folk festival. Hmm. I don't know when. It was years ago.
Yeah, there's been a few.
And it was, you did, and I also wanted to talk to you about covers, because you've got the fantastic cover album Thief. But in that to show, you did a cover of Rocky Raccoon.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
At Folk Fest? That's Folk hilarious. Fest. And it was probably like a Beatles workshop stage or something like that.
I don't remember. Like, yeah. I just remember I knew you were playing, and I'd seen you a couple times.
One of the first songs I ever learned to play.
Really?
Yeah, really, really.
The whole crowd was singing along.
Yeah.
And I just remember it being in that moment, because it's such a great tune. And it was, I remember being struck with that really, that big sense of community. So it's neat to hear you talk about that being cool. Something that.
I also love it. I love that thing when somebody comes up and they're like, man, that thing that you did at this festival or whatever 15 years ago, that has always stuck with me. And I don't remember it. Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. And it's not about like, the ego, or it's about like the idea that like, you don't know that thing you said in grade six that turned someone's life around, that thing, that gesture or that glance of kindness that you gave somebody when they needed it, that made them feel like they weren't alone or something like that. Like, none of us know the effect that we've had on the people around us. A stranger that you held a bus door for that helped them get to the residential tenancy bureau before it closed so you could get some help with your issue with your landlord or something. You know what I mean? Like, there's just a million infinitesimal little moments in your life that have added up to, you know, your story, but also other people's stories. I just love that. Like, I get off on that, you know, whatever that rabbit hole is.
I also think it's something that's something so beautiful about music and art, is that something that can be relatively innocuous or not just thoroughfare for somebody can be life-changing for somebody
else. I also find that like many of my songs mean something to me, and somebody be like, is this song about yada, yada, yada? And I'll be like,
I guess it is now.
Sure. Yeah. Like, I mean, like, if that's what's helpful to you, that's what it's about. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we all, get from songs what we need from them in that moment, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's perfectly fine. I also think it's hilarious when songs get like misconstrued, like when people, like a song like Born in the USA, you know, which is about immigration and it's all satire.
Ronald Reagan tried to use that for his campaign.
It's like people who watch Borat and they're like, they don't get the joke. Like, they think that like making fun of Jews is funny or something like that, because that's what they saw in Borat. And they don't realize that he's putting a mirror up and saying, no, this is the worst of us. And you're laughing at it. And then like, you know, like the layers of it are lost on people. Or like people, I remember one time it was at like a airport Ramada, you know, somewhere in the States, and there's some real estate convention going on. And there's like, you know, a bunch of white collar dudes in the bar letting loose at the end of a long, you know, weekend of seminars and panels, I can imagine. And they're dancing to Keep on Rocking in the Free World. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there's something like, you know, that is a satire song about how America is not as free as it believes it to be or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's hilarious.
Written by a Canadian.
Yeah. But it's hilarious. Yeah, it's hilarious to see people so like uninhibitedly not get the joke. Mm-hmm. And still on some level, as much as I want to like hate on that, I'm kind of like, well, yeah, man, fuck it. Dance. Feel good. You know, like, you know, you're just doing your best too. Just the same as we all are, you know?
You mentioned your, it's funny. I was going to ask you about this, and you mentioned that you're a literature major. And I kind of guessed it, cause I was like, well, he's got the Kurt Vonnegut, inspired title of your second album. Yeah. And then I only found this out recently. Oh, Fortune. Did you get the title from the poem?
No.
Or is it just coincidence?
Coincidence.
So that's just total coincidence. Cause there's
I knew that there was O Fortuna.
O Fortuna. Yeah. The medieval poem.
Yeah.
And then there's, Dan Mangan and Blacksmith Club Meds. Mm-hmm. The opening track is of Fred,
right?
Which is the
Handmaid's Tale
protagonist.
Yeah.
And then you've got a song called A Doll's House
/ Pavlovia.
Pavlovia. And then I even think it's not just literature, but there's the history reference. You've got a song in 16.
Yeah.
Roman numerals.
Yeah.
And the last line of the song is Marie Antoinette quote.
Yeah, let them eat cake. Yeah.
So is that something that just kind of happens naturally, or do you look for?
Yeah,
I'm sure if those are the four that I've caught.
Yeah, there's more.
There's tons that I didn't catch.
Rows of Houses, written from the perspective of Gordy Lachance, who's the protagonist from The Body.
Yeah,
you know, also Stand by Me, one of my favorite films.
Great film.
Yeah, and I'm not like I would never claim to be some like, you know, I know people who really read a lot of books, and I'm in awe and admiration of them. And I wouldn't want to try and like cast an unfair image of myself as some total book guru. But certainly I find that my mind is most alive when I'm like deep in a book. Mm-hmm. And I find if I'm really headlong into a great book, the song ideas just kind of, even if they have nothing to do with that book, The connection, you start seeing the world through the eyes of any character, and you start seeing connections to their world in the book, to your world as you see it, and the world. And I think that we all sort of like wander between these extremities of sort of a very automatic self. And let's say that that is like going to the bank and emptying the dishwasher and returning an email and, you know, running errands and sort of like, you know, eating and shitting. Yeah. And there's this sort of like rotation of like automatic things that you do. And then on the other side of it, you know, there's the more like romantic, the more intuitive, more like soulful, magical part of yourself. And at times you might find yourself feeling all of the weight of the world and seeing the connections between the news and, you know, bullies that you experienced in high school and a song that you heard and a film that you saw and your parents and your siblings. And like, you can just see these like points of connection and like energetic inertia in the world. And when you're tapped into that, you know, that's when I'm most able to really write songs. And I think when you're tapped into that is when lyrics kind of fall, as Leonard Cohen puts it, is just what your hand falls upon. You know, there are times when I will work 3 weeks to figure out one stupid line in a song, like a puzzle. And there are other times when something like notably poetic will just
fall into place.
And I'm like, where the fuck did that come from? You know? And I think that it's like, that is the result of like the sort of mystical magic of existence, but also that is the result of lots of, it's like if you've been lifting weights your whole life and you just like happen to lift up a car and save a kid, it's like all of that work, all of that muscle memory, all of that like preparation that you've done helps you to be unconsciously great in that moment, you know? And when it happens, you really, it's beautiful. And you know it, like, you know, when you've fallen upon something that is the truth. And you just gotta be thankful for those moments, because they don't come all the time. You know, sometimes you really have to work for it. So when it feels easy, but you feel like you've stumbled ass backwards into something that tells the truth, is really special.
Do you have, do you tend to lead when you're writing, do you tend to lead lyrically or musically?
It's all over the place, really. Sometimes I'll have like a whole song's worth of music figured out, or a, you know, and then sometimes I'll have a ton of lyrics and nothing to do with them. Oftentimes it'll be one phrase. It'll be like, you know, just looking at your wall here, like coffee and cigarettes, you know, great film. And so that one phrase would be like, you know, coffee and cigarettes or something like that. And then from there, a chord comes underneath it. Mm-hmm. And then you go, where does that go? What's the next change? You know, where does that go? And so every song is a little different. I feel like when I was really young, I listened to tons of Dave Matthews, and I was like really into like all his like fancy guitar work. Yeah. And so I was like, I want to write guitar parts that like are hard to figure out. That was like, I want to write really hard guitar parts, and then whatever, I'll figure out the melody later. As I got older, the guitar got simpler and simpler and simpler, and the melody became more and more and more important. Because not that I write songs so that they can be recreated by other people, but like for something to truly be kind of like iconic, it needs to be simple enough to like float over a 40,000 person crowd at a festival or something like that, you know? And I love great melodies that sort of give you what your brain is telling you want, you know, that resolve in that special way. And I think that all of our greatest songwriters are the people who are able to give us these little like endorphin hits of like, oh, look at all the lonely people. You know, there's something so satisfying about that melody. And if it went, oh, look at all the lonely people, it wouldn't be the same thing. But it goes, people. And then you go, oh, that, it just resolved so perfectly. You know, your brain wants it to resolve. Yeah. And so you got to give your brain what it's looking for. Not all the time, but, you know, in due course.
Do you approach, because you've, I guess in the last, within the last 5 to 10 years, you started scoring. Mm-hmm. And do you approach writing when you're scoring for film or television differently?
Definitely, yeah. And that's a very different beast. And that's something I never really expected I would get into, but it just sort of fell in my lap. 2012, we were pregnant with my first son, and I had been touring nonstop. I've been playing like 200 shows a year for like 5-6 years. It was just really relentless, and it was exciting, and it was, you know, all my dreams are coming true in many ways. But I was like, I was going to crash and burn. Like, I was going to have real burnout if I didn't change something. So I said to my manager, I was like, okay, I need like some time off the road. Let's take a break here. And when everything's going your way and you're really feeling the benefit of the doubt at every turn, it's hard not to feel like you can control it and that you could turn it off and turn it back on whenever you want. You know, like when the phone's always ringing and you're getting all these offers to play cool festivals and do this and do that, it just sort of feels like, yeah, like I could go away from this and it'll always be there for me. And so I said to my manager, I want a break from touring. And within a week, somebody, a producer of a film, you know, the Simon Pegg film, Hector and the Search for Happiness, called, and they were like, we're looking for a composer. And the director heard your name from their cousin and they really like what they've heard and they want a songwriter and they have to be Canadian and they don't want like a traditional composer. They want a songwriter. And I was like, okay. So, you know, ended up having like a 2-hour Skype meeting with the director and it clicked right away and it made sense. And so I started doing that, and I can't even read music. Like, I can record and produce music, but I can't read it on the page. And so worked with my pal, Jesse Zubat, and made this film. And then that, you know, the film kind of got like panned by the critics, unfortunately. It wasn't for this time, the film. It should have been made in the 90s. You know, right. It's kind of a 90s film. But it was a little bit too simple and a little bit too white guy for like, and it was just like, it was a little bit, it wasn't nuanced enough. And it just simplified things a little bit too much. Anyways, doing that score was an amazing experience and very humbling. You know, for the first time, I wasn't the dictator of the project. I was sort of just a cog in a much larger machine and having to work within the confines of that and budgets. And it was really humbling, but really powerful in many ways. And I really enjoyed it. And then I got offered to do some other stuff for Netflix and AMC and stuff. And so it all kind of fell in my lap. And at every turn, there was these panicked moments of like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Like, I'm taking on a feature film with all these stars on it, and I've never done anything like this before. But I think in life, you know, often you just have to say yes and then figure it out as you go. And then when you do that, you say yes, you figure it out, and then now your comfort zone's a little bigger than it was. Yeah. And you just keep doing that over and over and over and over again. And then you know, all of a sudden you have this massive comfort zone and you can wander between all these different things, and you just have to get over the, you know, sort of incremental imposter syndrome as you go. But it was, you know, it was really interesting because I got into scoring during that time where I was like, I don't want to tour for a while and I want to take a break. And I've had two careers, you know. I've had the initial wave that was with Juno Awards and, you know, everything kind of exploding and going in my favor and being on the cover of every Arts Weekly when we showed up in those towns. And then there was like a down period and I thought I could turn the tap back on. And when I turned the tap back on, it was just like dripping, you know, there was nothing there. And I feel like I've had to earn my career all over again, which is good because it means I don't take it for granted anymore.
Yeah.
And, but I'm, you know, I'm happy to say that at 40, you know, in an industry that is obsessed with youth culture, I feel like I have a place in it, you know?
And that's, you mentioned feeling you're starting again. I feel like your career started at a very interesting turning point, socially, musically. The way that we consume music was just post, you know, LimeWire and Napster.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Before Spotify.
Yeah.
What happened? Like I think your first album came out in 2005, I believe, right?
Yeah.
2 years later, Facebook launched.
Yeah.
And then that changed everything. It changed how
people
are marketed. It changed
how
you'd be exposed.
I booked my first tour on MySpace.
Yeah.
I remember putting my music on MySpace, and that was like a really exciting thing. My uncle told me about MySpace, you know, and then I was booking shows.
Remember Tom? Was it Tom?
Yeah, Tom was everyone's friend.
Everyone's friend.
But like, you know, at the time, like venues had a MySpace page. So I would just like message the MySpace page. That was how I find things. And I would put out tour listings and I'd say like Vancouver, Kamloops, Kelowna. And then in the description of the venue, it just said like, contact me, like, you know, like I'm looking for a space or whatever. And so I was literally like crowdsourcing shows and I did tons of house concerts, living room concerts, backyards.
You know? I feel like that was a bigger thing in the late aughts. Like
it's still happening. I went to a ton of them
when I was, maybe I'm just
old. I think you were just young and going to them. Yeah. Like, you know, that's probably what it was. They're still happening. They're happening all over the place. Like DIY sort of underground shows always happening. I did tons of that. And I was a real self-starter, you know, like I was DIY to the core. I was my own designer, my own webmaster, my own booking manager, agent for a long time. For a long time I was my own manager, dabbled with some different management that didn't go so well and then found somebody better and all these things. But it's been like I've had a crazy career. I've got crazy stories and I forget them. Like I forget. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it'll come out of me like, oh my God. Yeah, that's right. I did get into an argument with Brandon Flowers at a music festival, you know, like, oh yeah, that's right. And it's cool. Like, I've told this story before, but like, I ended up on Willie Nelson's tour bus with Snoop Dogg at Glastonbury one year. And it was like, what is going on? Like, what is my life right now? You know? And so
times have you done Glastonbury?
I did it twice. What a crazy festival, 250,000 people.
I've never been. My girlfriend's been like four times. She's from England.
It's totally insane. It's bigger than anything you can imagine.
Happen, but it's like over 150,000 people.
Or something. No, like right? More. It's like 200,000 plus like 50,000 volunteers.
Yeah, that's
insane. And workers and crew and techs and drivers.
But imagine half the size of Vancouver.
Yeah, like imagine a festival that spanned like from like all of downtown Vancouver, and it would take you like 2 hours to walk across it because you're in gumboots and there's mud everywhere and like every pathway is like, you know, a foot deep of mud and you're just like going, it's insane. The thing I love about Glastonbury is that to this day they will not pay a headliner more than £200,000 and all of the profits go to charity. It's like, cool. It's run as a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And it's the most successful music festival, I think, in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there were some bigger ones in South America or something like that. But it's completely bonkers. It's kind of hell in a way, but it's incredible, you know? And I've had experiences at Glastonbury where it's like 4 a.m. and you are altered, you know? And you're sort of wandering around, and then this like group of pixies surrounded me and started ballet dancing around, you know, it's like flash mob heaven, you know, like just crazy stuff, crazy. It's just bonkers experiences. It's a really cool thing to do once or twice and then, you know, maybe never again.
Yeah. How do you feel, circling back around to you know, talking about you know, getting started, reaching out to venues through MySpace, and being in the game at 20 and being in the game at 40, how do you feel, like how much has the industry changed for you that 20 years?
It changes every 6 months, like every record cycle. Oh, it's a different game now. You know, when I put out Club Meds 2015, Spotify was a thing, but it wasn't really something that you like put a lot of weight into.
Right.
And then by the time I put out More or Less in 2018, Spotify was the only thing that mattered. And it was all about getting on these editorial playlists. Cause if you got onto the right playlists, your career was made. And then now it's all algorithmic playlists, and the algorithm is dictated by, you know, listen time, but it's also dictated by what's going on TikTok and what's going on. So it's like this integration between social media. Basically, as time passes on, the industry is relying less and less on gatekeepers who have intuition about what might work and relying solely on what is already proven in the field by hard numbers. And those hard numbers come from likes, follows, watch time, comments, et cetera. And so it's essentially leaning on social media to do all of that groundwork and figure out what it like. There's no risk involved anymore. Like labels are signing things because based on your followers, they know that you will sell this many or stream this many things. And then you hope for a bump and maybe you can get above that. But like everything is calculable down to the cent now, in a way that's different. When I was starting out, it was all about like, how do I get on the cover of this magazine? Because that's a cool magazine and people who like cool music like that magazine. Now, you know, I could be on the cover of...
Kids are like, what's a magazine?
Yeah, like, you know, like you get on the cover of Paste magazine, nobody cares, mm-hmm. you know? You get a feature in Rolling Stone, nobody cares. Like nothing, the only thing that matters is this going viral. And so those magazines, those legacy magazines, their place in the market is basically at this point, their job is to write, you know, big stories about things that have already occurred, but nothing is breaking on them. Nothing is breaking right. on those magazines. They can celebrate things that are going on and be a part of the culture, but they're not breaking bands anymore the way that they were.
Yeah.
Which is good and bad. You know, I really believe that you can't fight the change. If you change or die. And even when like Napster was first around and people were, you know, Lars Ulrich was going on about how this is the end of the music industry. I was like,
I just watched that South Park episode.
Yeah, right.
The one where they go on strike.
And I remember going like, I remember playing shows and being like, you know what? I think probably half the people here are here because their friend sent them an illegal pirated thing. Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, I'll take it. You know, for me, it was like, it was a means to an end. Because I didn't have powerful distribution. You couldn't find my records in record shops all over the world. But if you could download it, you can get it anywhere. And I would take it because often people would, I'd heard it at the merch table tons back in the day. Like I pirated your album, but I'm here at the concert and I want to buy it for real now because you know, I want to support you. I really do believe people want to support art. They want to put their money and their time and their energy toward things that make them feel that existing is good. And art does that for people. It affirms something.
I remember being that age, mid-20s, like late teens to mid-20s, just broke, mm-hmm. And going to concerts and saying similar things, being mm-hmm. like, or buying a t-shirt, being like, I've got all of your music downloaded illegally, but I paid,
oh, man.
Like, but I'll buy a hoodie.
When a band comes to town and they put me on the guest list, I always buy merch. Cause it's like, you know, how can I support you? You know, mm-hmm. one way or another.
I do the same thing with bands that roll through Guilt & Co. I'll buy that.
But you got a big record collection at this point.
I do.
Yeah.
and a broken turntable.
Yeah.
Which is very sad.
Well, they can fix it for you at what's it called? The place at 10th and Alma.
Is it still there?
I think it's still there. At least I don't know. Maybe
I think I looked it up a while ago, and I think things might be changed so quickly. Things do change. Yeah.
But that place was like, I remember going in there. I can't remember what it's called now, but they fixed turntables and they sold turntables, and it was like this like bastion of like a time gone by.
Yeah.
And every time I went in there, I was like, this might be the last time I come in here.
It's actually really frustrating because technically the turntable isn't broken. Turntable works fine. But it's a turntable with just like RCA output, but I'm trying to connect it to a soundbar.
Oh yeah.
We've got all the new connections. And so I'd somewhere between the turntable and the preamp and the converter and the adapter, something doesn't work, but I don't know what. So I literally have to take the whole thing into someone that's smart and go.
Troubleshooting hellhole.
Yeah. I gave up a while ago. you mentioned earlier, we were talking about your work at scoring, and saying yes. Because scoring is how you cross paths with Dave Grohl, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that film I mentioned earlier was being directed by a guy named Peter Chelsom, mm-hmm. Who lives in LA, and his kids go to the same school as Dave Grohl, and they're very tight. And so he was like, he's a British guy, he's like, oh, I'd love to get Dave involved in this. And there was a rough cut of the film. I went down to LA, went to Dave's house and watched the rough cut in his living room with Peter and Dave. You know, you show up at Dave's house and he's wearing like a ripped Sears t-shirt and he's holding like a microwave burrito. You know, he's like very normal dude and very sweet, very affable and human. And we go to his little kind of home studio area afterwards. He's like, so what do you want me to do? You know? And there's this famous, I've told this story before, but there was a song that was going to play over the credits of the film. and he offered to play drums on the song. But like literally a week before, we had just tracked the drums. And I really didn't want to hurt the feelings of my drummer. And I said, no, I was like, oh, sorry, we already did that. And he was like, come on, man, just let me do them again. You know? And he's like, he's looking at me like I was the drummer in Nirvana. Like, you know, like,
I'm Dave Grohl.
Like, you should let me play drums in your song. And in the moment, you know, I was feeling precious about the art. And I was like, nope, we've already done that. And I'm happy with it. And I like the direction that we took with it. And, you know, I want to be loyal to my band and all those things. And so I said, no. And he did sing on the song, and he did, you know, spend some time, like he recorded some guitar for it that we didn't really use. We barely used it. And it was, man, like looking back with a sort of like pragmatic mm-hmm. brain, I think if I had said yes, I would have come back to LA like a couple of weeks later or something, whenever it worked for his schedule. And I would have spent a day tracking that song with him. We would have gone to lunch and we would have like cracked jokes. And we would have hung out for the day and we would have been buds, you know, might not have been best friends, but we would have been buds. And I realize now, like there's more than a few times in my career where I have stunted my own opportunities.
You know?
Something came up in front of me and I was like, nah, for one reason or another. And, it's not to say that I made the wrong call, but it's interesting to recognize those moments mm-hmm. because then anytime I'm feeling like, man, why isn't my song getting streamed more? Or like, you know, if I'm feeling underappreciated by the world, I can look back and be like, well, I made some choices that have affected the reach of what I do.
Yeah.
And so that's on me. And as long as I can recognize that, you know, and I'm not stricken with regret, but it helps me sort of compartmentalize these feelings yeah. that I have.
So saying no to things that you wouldn't know to say yes to things now, unless you had said no sure. to something that maybe you should have said yes to.
Exactly.
It teaches us how to be more open, I think.
Yeah. Like I think every relationship you're in, you know, that doesn't work out, mm-hmm. you learn something. You're like, oh, I'm never going to be with somebody who does that. You know, that thing that they did. God, that pissed me off.
I'm never going to do that again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or like, man, that really, but I remember when I first started dating my wife, she said, can you do something for me? If I'm ever like singing along, can you just never ask me to stop? Like she, and apparently like her ex-boyfriend or something had said to her, sometimes she'd be like singing in the car and he'd be like, can you not do that? Or, you know, and it really bugged her that she was just like,
that would bug me.
It would bug me too. But she recognized like, you know, that was like something that her ex did and it made her feel bad.
Yeah.
So she was like, she course correct.
She knew to ask for it.
She knew to ask for it, you know, just like, and it's like, it's probably something I never, ever would have done, but she knew to ask to make sure, you know? And I think that we all do that in many things. You know, you quit a job you hate, you know, I'm never going to work a job like that. And it's not even like, I'm never going to work in that field or I'm never, you know. It's like, I'm never going to work for a place that makes me feel that way again. And there's something about it, some red flag along the way that, you know, so we're all learning all the time. And I say this to my kids all the time. Like, you know, there's no true mistakes in that. Like the only thing that would make it a mistake is if you don't learn anything from it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're learning from those mistakes, it's great. It's a lesson at that point. It's no longer a mistake. And if it's just only if you repeat it over and over and over again, that's a mistake.
Yeah. Was there a moment looking back on that decision to turn down Dave Grohl's drumming? Was there a moment where you can look, there was a moment where you look back and you had changed your, do you remember when you changed your mind about it?
It was years later. For a long time, I was like, yeah, I fucking said no to Dave Grohl, you know, I was stuck to my guns, you know, and I honestly, the song that he would have played drums on is a song called Vessel. And when I hear that song come on at like a coffee shop or something, mm-hmm. I'm like, sounds really good. I'm still happy with that song creatively.
Yeah.
Stuck to my guns. I trusted my gut and I feel great about it. So, you know, it's not all bad. Mm-hmm. But it was years later you know, I think probably when I was in one of my harrowing like pits of despair about my career, which inevitably comes, like every couple of years, I'll spend 2 months in total and utter existential, you know, fear. And I was in one of those when I was like kind of reflecting
right,
on that,
yeah.
And then going like, oh, that's my bad, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, on some level, if we look at a lot of truly successful people in this world who are borderline narcissists or sociopaths, I'm not saying all successful people are that way, but like, you know, if we look at the Trumps of the world or whatever, the people who are willing to step on anybody's back for their own promotion and their own benefit, I don't really want that either, you know?
Yeah.
I remember reading a biography about Neil Young, in which Neil Young, in his later years, kind of talked about how when he was young, he was so ruthlessly ambitious that like he would backstab anyone if it meant that it would help his career, which is an interesting thing to reflect upon as an icon, you know? And I know people. I mean, I've been in this business long enough and I've been around enough successful people. I know people, I look them in the eye and I'm like, oh, you're a piece of work. Like you're a narcissist, you know, like you've fooled people into thinking that you're this happy, you know, friendly guy, but you're bad news. And there, a lot of those people are way more successful than I am. And I have often thought like, sure, I'm jealous of their success, but you can't trade your life. Like, let's say you could trade your life for somebody else's. You couldn't just trade for their success. You'd have to be them. And imagine being them. That would suck. I don't want to be them. I want to be me.
Yeah.
I want to be me, but with their success.
Yeah.
And you know, it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. And so if I have to choose like my life, my kids, my amazing wife and my career where it is. And I also acknowledge that like my career, there are other people who are jealous of my career. You know, it's all rational. It's all subjective.
Yeah.
You know, I have people who are like, that's my Achilles heel. That band or that artist is like, oh, they're the one who always get booked instead of me. And they're the one who are kind of like me, but more successful or whatever. And I'm sure that there are other bands just a few rungs beneath me on the ladder going like, fucking guy, Dan Mangan, I hate that guy, you know? And we're all just out here doing our best. You know?
Yeah.
That's all any of us can do.
Yeah. And I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's your whole reasoning for that moment of was you wanted to stay loyal to your band.
I wanted to stay loyal to the band.
There's something to be said for that.
And I wanted the integrity of the song to not be compromised. And I felt like I had already figured out a path for that song.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dave Grohl was the most incredible rock drummer, you know, of an era or maybe ever. And it doesn't mean that he's right for my band.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. He's incredible. I'm sure it would have been great. It would have been lots of fun and we would have found something that worked out really great. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just because he's famous doesn't mean that he's the right ticket.
Yeah.
Creatively, you know, to fit that puzzle. I don't know.
I heard you talk recently in an interview. I think it was either August of this year or August of last year, but it was you talking about your newest album. And you broke it down into four acts.
Mm.
Is that something that do you frame most of your albums that way, or
No, and it almost happened by accident. You know, as we were sort of like figuring out the sequence, I was putting together the sequence of the album the same way I would put together the sequence of any album, which is like, you know, front load it with some really juicy, awesome stuff, but retain some really sneakily awesome stuff for the back half, and you know, make sure that it flows song to song nicely and make sure it sort of like tells a story as it goes. And as I was doing that, I realized that I'd sort of inadvertently, you know, lyrically put it into these four sections. So the first couple songs are sort of like state of the world songs. Like this is what's going on in the world. This is how we're all dealing with it. The second act, which was, you know, another three songs, was sort of like, this is how I'm doing in and amongst this greater zeitgeist. And these are my feelings of, you know, trouble. And then the third act was sort of like, well, here's some ideas about maybe how I could help. And here are some ideas about how we could help each other. And, you know, how there's a line in one of the songs that's how can I help you to be still? And so that was sort of like the name of the third act, you know, how can I help you to feel still and complete and peaceful? And then the final act, which is just the final song, is a song called No Tragedy, Please, which sort of sums up the relationship between pain and love and the relationship between grief and joy, and how, you know, the deeper you love something, the more you're afraid of it going away and the more it hurts when it's gone. And so, you know, the lines of the chorus are, you know, maybe too many things really matter to me. Maybe loss just affirms the value of everything. Maybe love is a curse and we'll never be free. You know, if we're loving anything, that means we're going to feel pain. And then the final line, maybe there in the sting lies the real poetry. And it's like, maybe that's why life is awesome, is because to love anything is to feel pain. And that relationship between those two things makes anything worthwhile. And so that sort of summed up the record. It was like, you know, here's why it all means anything at all. And the record was made over 2.5 years. Worked with this guy.
It was recorded remotely too, right?
Completely remote. I spent 3 days in the studio with Drew. I worked with Drew Brown. He's in Chicago the whole time. He's worked with Radiohead and Beck and, you know, so many of my favorite bands. And he's a genius. He's incredible. But it was like a really hard experience to make a record over that length of time. And, you know, just waiting. You send something in, probably waiting and waiting.
Took
and waiting.
That much longer because you're not in the room.
Oh, man. Like something that would take 20 minutes to figure out if you're in the same room. 20 minutes of discussing and messing around with the computer or something, you could figure it out. It would take 6 weeks, you know, just back and forth. And it was just like, it was painful. It was the most drawn out experience. And we were totally at the limits of what was possible at the time. I mean, during the pandemic. So I was like not in a terrible rush to release anything because I knew that I couldn't really do much with it once I did release it. So, you know, in a sense, I was sort of not in a hurry to finish it, but I was certainly in a hurry to feel the fruition of any creative project. So the bad news is that it was hard. The good news is that it's a really special record that could never be recreated. It was a moment in a time. The songs are not tied to the pandemic. It's not like you have to be during a pandemic to enjoy these songs, but the production of it, the process of getting there was very much tied to the pandemic. And so I'm grateful for it. I appreciate what it is. And I think it's the best record I've ever made.
And you launched, started Side Door around the same time, right?
I actually started Side Door before the pandemic. So Side Door is a marketplace for the arts. It's a startup. It's basically a place where it's a website where any space that you have is a venue. So this room that we're in right now, this could be a Side Door venue. Create a profile for your loft or your warehouse or your backyard or your living room or whatever. Connect directly with artists. You can book shows together. Those shows, you know, you sell tickets and then you can split the revenue between the space and the artist. And, you know, every show you can kind of create a different revenue split. Everyone gets paid out automatically directly to their bank account afterwards. So it's sort of like this lean booking machine for booking shows off the grid, you know, outside of the traditional venue spaces. And it's all built on this philosophy of, you know, if we can decentralize the live entertainment industry a little bit, we could potentially foster a really vibrant middle class of artistry where people can make a living doing what they love, even if they're not famous. And it's been around since 2017. We've paid out about $1.7 million to artists, and we've done 1,000 in-person shows and another 1,200 online shows during the pandemic. It's been this sort of like really cool project. It's been hard in all the same ways as having a music career is hard, you know, trying to get a startup off the ground is difficult, but it's been really rewarding. And when I see it work, like when I see the videos or the footage from shows that Side Door helped facilitate, it's amazing to feel like, you know, it's helping artists make a living in a way that's really like low overhead for them and high reward. And it's special, and it's creating, you know, magical memories and experiences for hosts and audiences everywhere.
Do you feel like it's harder in today to sort of make a living as a middle-class musician than it was
absolutely
20 years ago?
Absolutely. Yeah. Touring, you know, it's like record revenue dried up and then everyone's like, oh, everyone's got to tour more. And then now touring is getting squeezed. I mean, hotels, fuel, rentals, buses, trains, planes, whatever. It's all way more expensive. What's not much more expensive is ticket costs, you know, like
right.
Maybe to go see Beyonce in an arena is $300-$500 to start, but going to see a show at Media Club or whatever is barely more expensive than it was 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And, but yet the cost of traveling and the cost of having a band on the road, what we're seeing is the decimation of band culture. So you will notice if you looked at how many bands were being signed to record labels 10, 15 years ago, it would probably be like 60% of the market. And then the other 40% were solo acts. Now it's like 95% solo acts mm-hmm. because what's happening is that bands are getting famous on social media or artists are getting famous on social media, not necessarily because they're amazing artists, but because they're really good at capturing a following. They make content that people like and they are releasing music that those followers are listening to. But it's too hard to have a band now. You know, I see a band like the Beaches, who I'm buddies with, kind of exploding right now. There's a part of me that's just so relieved to see an actual band breaking in that way right now, because it's really tough to do. It's almost like bands are almost extinct. You know, obviously we all love lots of bands, but those are bands that you've loved for 10, 15 years. I'm talking about new bands that are kind of breaking in that way. It almost doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of like the, with, you know, you have artists like Tash Sultana, mm-hmm. who as amazing as she is, she's, you know, skyrocketing to the top in the death rattle of the bands.
Yeah, right. Right. Well, and it's like maybe less than ever the music is the product, right? Like the product is the person. Like the product is now like how people feel when they see your stuff on their feed. And it's about like being cool or acting cool or looking cool or having the right caption and, you know, oh my God, I'm obsessed. You know, it's like, so that there's a viral video going around about how embarrassing it is to promote music on TikTok. And it was like, oh my God, did I make the song of the summer? You know? And it's true. We're in a weird era, you know, where the artists that are succeeding are the ones who know how to package things correctly. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe there's good things about it. You know, I'm forever an optimist. And I think that there's always a plus side to whatever's going on in the industry. There's always something exciting going on. And so you just got to find it. But I do worry, you know, I grew up loving bands, you mm-hmm. know, and solo artists too. But like, you know, is there going to be another Radiohead? Well,
yeah,
there never could be.
Even the going, like I remember, did you grow up in Vancouver?
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up everywhere, but I landed here for high school.
High school. What high school did you go to?
Lord Byng.
Oh, crazy.
My side. Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up in the suburbs. I was out in Tawasin. Hmm.
I lived in Tawasin when I was a kid for 1 year.
Oh, crazy.
I went to, what was it called? I lived in what they call the village out by the there's a totem pole.
Yeah.
Scanna Drive. Yeah. That was where we lived. And there was,
what elementary school were you at?
If you name a few, I'll know.
English. That would have been
English Bluff.
English Bluff.
That was me. Yeah. I went to English Bluff.
Yeah. So I probably went to high school with people that you were in elementary school.
Probably, yeah. It's a small world, man.
Super small world. But I remember being in high school and having older friends that were in the music scene, and like, you know, getting them to sneak me into the the back door of the venue when they were loading into their gear, so that I could go to the show.
Yeah,
because I was underage.
Yeah, so exciting.
But I wasn't going to get fucked up. I didn't really drink until I was old enough to drink, because I didn't want to like deal with it.
No, you want to be a part of the scene.
It was about being a part of the scene. It was about going to see going to see bands. Yeah. It's something that, you talk about it changing and it being a weird time. I think that a lot of people, and culture isn't linear, mm-hmm. right? I think people go, oh, we're here now, we're here now, we're here now, we're yeah. here now, we're here now.
There's also
it's
like,
more like a pendulum swinging around all over
totally.
The place.
Totally. And at every given time, there's like 1,000 different cultures happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, everyone in their algorithm has found their niche, right? Like every day there's a band playing Rogers Arena I've never heard of.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Like, you know, it just goes to show like there's an appetite for a lot of different things, which is kind of cool. You
I thought
know,
you're going to say there's an app for everything.
Yeah, there is. Well, there's that too. But you know, like you'll end up on Spotify and you'll see some artist you've never heard of, like mm-hmm. never heard of them. 21 million monthly listeners or something like that, you know, and you're yeah. just like, what is going on? And as much as I feel old now to touch when I do that, I'm also sort of like fucking sweet, you know, like I hate signifiers of a monoculture. Mm-hmm. And so I get really excited when I'm reminded about like how, like even within pop music, there's like 100 channels, you know, and then you get into other weirder music and there's all sorts of stuff. But there's so many lanes, which is really cool. And so I think that what artists are doing more and more is just like fostering whatever community they can build within that lane and worrying less about ubiquity, mm-hmm. you know, like there's going to be fewer and fewer Billie Eilish's and Taylor Swift's and Beyonce's, Ned Sheeran's, and, you know, more bands that are, you know, selling out arenas all around the world. But they're not household names, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. Yeah.
Do you, how often do you get out to shows? You still go to shows?
There was a period of about 6 or 7 years where I would have said, what's a show? Mm-hmm. You know, when my kids were quite little, just because going out at night was such a big deal.
Your oldest was born in 13?
2013. So they're 10 and 7 now. Yeah. So it's a little easier to get a babysitter. And if I was to go out on my own to a show, you know, it doesn't feel quite like I'm abandoning my wife the way it was when they were really little. And as the kids get older, it just gets easier to do more stuff. And also they're getting old enough, you know, we took them to the Tim Baker show at St. James the other day. And it was awesome. It was like, it was the first time we took them out to a show together and us yeah. as a family, or actually, and we saw Jill Barber, our friend Jill Barber earlier this year. That's really cool. Like, I like the idea that they're getting old enough that they can appreciate going to shows mm-hmm. with us. So it's happening more and more.
Have they been to any of yours yet?
Oh yeah. 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 They've been to a few of mine, and that's always fun. I think more than the show, they're excited to have the all access pass yeah. around their neck. And, yeah. you know, they just know that they can go wherever they want in the venue. Yeah. That's the most exciting thing for them.
Yeah. And you're this episode won't air. This will be past tense by the time it comes out, but you're playing tomorrow at the Vogue, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. How many times have you played the Vogue? Can you even count?
I'm going to guess, if you include sort of like cameos with other bands and fundraisers yeah. and sort of like, I don't know, a dozen? Yeah, a lot.
Yeah. And then you're going up, you've got a European tour starting in the spring, right?
Yeah, I was out with the Lumineers in Europe back in June and did a handful of shows with them. And so I'm kind of cycling back and hitting all of those same cities again, but this time for my own, you know, much smaller yeah. shows. Yeah.
And you're you got a single that you just released on Spotify, but it's actually three tracks that are on your 2022 album.
Yeah. So there's three songs. The record's called Being Somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I've reimagined three of those songs, and we're calling them Elsewhere versions.
Yeah. And, I like that.
That was really fun. I just made them in my basement, you know, almost entirely alone.
So you've got, you know, we've talked about, we've touched on, I think, all of your major albums. I know the kind of the way the music is being released, it's a big part of what's changed in the last 20 years. The, you know, it used to be back in the day, you would release the single and then you'd release the album. Mm-hmm. But now it's you talk about, you know, content and going viral and TikTok and flooding the market and all those things. For your next release or series of releases, is it going to be another full length album, or do you think you'll release it more pieces?
Yeah. I mean, I have a bunch of music recorded that's in the bag that we'll be releasing. And they call it kind of like drip marketing, or like drip, mm-hmm. you know, you're kind of dripping things rather than, because you get, you know, the amount of press you get for a new single is like almost as much as you get for a new album. So right. if you can just keep dripping singles, you know, the idea is that you might attract more attention. I worry about the death of the album a little bit, but if you look at even what's being streamed the most in certain genres on Spotify, it is full albums. People are listening to Zach Bryan's full album and Morgan Wallen's full album and Taylor Swift's full album and Ed Sheeran's full album. And of course, the singles are still the big ones, mm-hmm. but they are doing it. People are listening to these albums front to back. And I think that's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
I think I'll always make albums, but I'll also, I mean, there is something freeing about like, you make an album and you put like 3 years of work into it, and then you spend like 2 years peddling it and trying to get it out there. And it's, there is something exhausting about that model. And there's something a little bit exciting about writing a song, recording it right away, and then releasing it 6 weeks later, you know? Yeah. And there's something about that model that is a little bit exciting to me. Mm. That said, you know, there's something special about an album too. And I don't think that'll ever go away, just to some extent.
I hope it doesn't. I love the album. I worry about the death of the album.
And people, like, when people walk away from a concert, that, you know, if you don't have LPs to sell, they'll buy t-shirts and they'll buy other posters and stuff. But like, there is something about like when you buy an LP, it's wrapped in cardboard. And if you bend that cardboard, it's always bent. You can't unbend it. You know, it's like, it's always ripped. And I think that in a world where so much media is available on demand and with infinite, you know, capacity, it's cool to have something finite, like the power of a photo that gets burned in a fire and that photo is gone. There is something special about, you know, the, what's the word? The sort of mortality of art in that medium, which is kind of cool. But, you know, also I stream most of the, I have a big record collection. I listen to records, but I still, 80% of the time, I'm still on Spotify.
Yeah, I think everybody is.
And there's, it's amazing. I discover new artists on there all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's I don't resist the change. I sometimes complain about it, but I don't resist it. I think
that's just called getting old.
It's
just, I know how to.
Yelling at the sky.
I don't think anyone knows how to do it without complaining.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, when you think about like the coolest old people, like you think about the coolest 80-year-olds out there, like none of them are grumpy.
Yeah.
Like they're all people who have embraced it and are just thankful and find good things to be appreciative of. And that's how I want to be, you know, I don't want to be a grumpy old piece of shit.
Yeah.
It sucks.
I want to, before we close out, I want to ask you about, we mentioned it earlier, about Thief, your cover album. Mm. I think you released it in 2020.
Something like that. Who knows? Yeah.
So, I remember the first time I heard this one specific song come on. It's a song that very few people that are in my everyday circle actually know this band, because they released two albums. The second one was in 1998 and then did nothing afterwards.
Yeah.
And I don't even know their first one, but it's Neutral Milk Hotel, mm-hmm. And the cover of In the Airplane Over the Sea. It's one of my favorite records. I love that record so much.
That song, that's one of the best songs ever.
It's so good. I guess if there was a question, because that record's also got REM and Lauryn Hill on it, mm-hmm. and John Hyatt.
Bunch of stuff.
I cake? Don't find cake. It's got cake on it. Yeah, yeah. Were these all songs that had significance to you before recording it, or was it?
Yeah, I think so. Losing My Religion, I was just literally thinking, I've never heard a cover of that song. Mm-hmm. It's like one of the most famous songs that I can think of, you know, never heard a cover. I want to do a cover of that. I've always loved that Lauryn Hill song. And at one point I was messing around with a drum machine and I came up with this beat that sounded kind of cool. And I started humming that song. I was like, I'll do that. John Hyatt, I got asked to pitch for for to record a version of that song for an ad. So I made a demo of that song, and then I didn't get the ad, but I liked the demo, so I turned it into a full recording. And then In the Airplane Over the Sea, the new Chumoke Hotel song, which was my the original version of that song was my first dance at my wedding.
Oh, really?
A very, very important song to me. But my wife's aunt passed away a few years ago, and I couldn't attend the funeral. She flew down to go, but I stayed home with the kids. But I recorded that version of that song and gave it to Kirsten on a CD or whatever, so she sent her a Dropbox link or whatever, so that when she was at the funeral, they could play the song at the funeral. And so I had that recording in hand just from doing that. And I was like, oh, maybe I should release that, you know? And then Cake, I sang that song at my brother's wedding. And he was like, for Christmas this year, could you record that song? And that would be my present. So I recorded that. You know, it was like all these, I at no point was I like, I'm going to record a covers album. I just ended up having like these 10 different cover songs that I'd sort of haphazardly done over the course of 10 years. And I was like, oh, I should package them all up and put them out online so other people can hear them. And that's what that was.
Yeah. So it did that. The Neutral Milk Hotel song came on like the algorithm played it. It was Spotify and came on.
That
and I was like, I know that song and I know that voice. But, so it was cool to hear.
Oh, that's cool.
Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Nice chat with you. Thank you for the mezcal.
Give you a little small cheers here.
Yeah, cheers. As I do my tiny little pre-show sips.
Yeah. Cheers.